We saw our people in Europe in the endless procession of death. We saw the ghettos going up in flames. We saw the oppressor plotting against us all. And from down the corridors of history, we heard the echo of those other wars. Not logic, but instinct said imperatively, no, not civil war, not that at any price. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 84, The Revolt. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Studying the sweep of Jewish history, one might suggest that the Jewish revolt against Rome was spiritually doomed from the very beginning when a revolutionary named Menachem entered the city, and that almost two millennia later, the spiritual path was paved for Jewish restoration when a very different revolutionary named Menachem learned from all that had come before and made those lessons manifest in his leadership. Let us begin by giving a description of the layout of Second Temple Jerusalem on the eve of the great Jewish rebellion against Rome. And here, as in my description of the revolt itself, I'm enormously indebted to the excellent short history, A Temple in Flames, published by Gershon Bar Kochva and Aaron Horvitz. The heart and soul of Jerusalem was, of course, the Temple, which stood at the eastern end of the city, across the Kidron Valley from the Mount of Olives. Directly north of the Temple sat the Antonia Fortress, created by Herod and utilized by the Romans until the revolt. As Bar Kochva and Horvitz note, quote, "The strategic importance of the Antonia is illustrated in the idea expressed by Josephus, that whoever controlled the temple controlled the city, and whoever controlled the Antonia controlled the temple." End quote. South of the Temple Mount was the original city of David, occupied at this point largely by the poor, and known as the Lower City. West of the temple, in the general area of the Armenian and Jewish quarter of Jerusalem in our own age, was the Upper City, site of the wealthy and aristocratic denizens of Jerusalem, as well as a location for Roman soldiers and authorities. At the edge of the Upper City were three enormous towers built by Herod, named Hippicus, Phazael, and Mariam. The wall surrounding the Lower and Upper City, known as the First Wall, was created by the Hasmoneans. The second wall was Herodian in origin, expanding north of the Temple Mount, and a third larger wall encompassed a more suburban area even further north, named Bizeta. Following the death of Agrippa I, Jerusalem was led by a series of Roman procurators, with Agrippa II given authority over the temple complex itself. Every procurator was cruel, but the last, Gessius Florus, was the worst of all, and even the Roman historian Tacitus ruefully reflected that Florus's tyranny provoked the revolt. The event that sparked the rebellion occurred not in Jerusalem, but Caesarea, when a pagan sacrificed a bird near a synagogue in order to provoke the Jewish populace. Provoked, the Jews were. Then, many of the Jews of Caesarea were murdered in response. Angered by Gessius Florus's apparent lack of interest in protecting the Jewish community, the Jews of Jerusalem responded with mockery to Florus's request for silver from the treasury of the temple, and Florus, in turn, ordered his soldiers to massacre any Jerusalemite in their path. Josephus tells us that 3,600 Jews were murdered in this massacre. At this point, understanding the anger that was simmering in Jewish Jerusalem, and knowing that his fellow Jews wished for him to lobby Nero against Florus, Agrippa II gathered the Jews of Jerusalem near the Hasmonean Palace, which, as Josephus tells us, was, quote, "at the passage to the upper city where bridge joined the temple to the gallery," end quote. This bridge apparently is today known as Wilson's Arch, which forms the sort of cave where people pray in the northern edge of the Kotel Plaza. Agrippa told the assembled populace of the many peoples that had been defeated by Rome and pleaded with the residents of Jerusalem not to bring the wrath of Rome upon themselves and upon the temple. The elite Sadducee priesthood, interestingly, seems to have been somewhat divided, with many utterly opposed to any revolution, including one who served as high priest named Hanania. But the revolution itself is taken to have begun when, in the summer of 66, Hanania's son Eliezer refused to offer the usual sacrifice to God on behalf of the emperor. Eliezer is often seen as the first leader in Jerusalem of the rebel group known as the Zealots. He was joined in the city by another rebel named Menachem, whose band of men were called Sicarii, or daggers. Menachem's men astonishingly raided the Roman garrison at Masada, stole its weapons cache, and brought those weapons to Jerusalem. A civil war then ensued between anti-revolt Jews and those in favor of rebellion. Originally, the upper city was held by the priests opposed to the revolt, sustained by 2,000 cavalry that had arrived from Agrippa. The lower city and the temple were held by rebel forces. The rebels conquered the upper city and then overpowered the Romans in the Antonia Fortress. A little more than 2 weeks after this, the Sicarii captured the Roman garrisons that had taken shelter in Herod's towers on the upper city walls and killed almost all of the Romans. It is at this point that Menachem, leader of the Sicarii, did the unthinkable, killing Hananiah, who again had served as high priest, for the latter's opposition to the revolt. This led Eliezer, the rebel leader, to understand that he had allied himself to a man who ultimately murdered his father, a man who had suddenly donned royal robes and apparently acquired a messiah complex. Eliezer therefore came upon Menachem in the temple and killed some of Menachem's men. While Menachem originally fled, he was later discovered, and as Josephus candidly writes, quote, "They took him alive and drew him out before them all. Then they tortured him with many sorts of torments, and after all, slew him," end quote. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the beginning of the Jewish revolt, with the leaders of various factions in Jerusalem killing each other. It is true that many of the negative descriptions of these men that we have today come from Josephus, someone who, as we will see, originally joined the rebellion and then switched sides. The historian Cecil Roth compared Josephus to Benedict Arnold and asks us to imagine how we would approach a history of the American Revolution that Arnold might have written. A passage in that history, Roth suggests, would have gone something like this. Quote, "In the winter of 1779, large numbers of these brigands gathered together in the hill country near Philadelphia, at a spot named Valley Forge. They were led by an ex-officer named Washington, who had been impelled by ambition to repudiate his oath of allegiance and place himself at the head of the rebels. From this favorable position, they carried out raids on those peaceful farmers in the vicinity who remained loyal to the government," end quote. So, Roth writes, a history of the revolution by Arnold might have been composed. And he adds, quote, "Imagine this spirit protracted over a long work, and you have Josephus's account of the war of 66 to 70. It is the historian's task," Roth continues, "to distinguish the true motives and attitudes behind the actions and personalities which we know only from Josephus's jaundiced pages," end quote. Roth's point is well taken, but the truth is that not only Josephus, but also the sages of the Talmud stress that sinat chinam, baseless hatred, festered in Jerusalem and brought about the city's fall and the failure of the rebellion. Historians often describe Jerusalem's rabbis or Pharisees as being of a pacifist bent, but in my view, the evidence indicates otherwise. The rabbis understood the cruelty and tyranny of Rome, and they believed that morally a revolution would be justified. And they further understood, unlike Agrippa, that with God's help, victory over an empire was possible. But the rabbis also believed that victory would not be merited, and therefore victory would not occur, if Jewish unity in Jerusalem was not achieved. Thus, if I may return to Roth's American Revolution example, I would suggest that to understand the failure of the Jewish revolt against Rome, we have to imagine what would have happened in America had George Washington tried to kill his fellow general Charles Lee, or what would have occurred had the Continental Congress chosen to torture John Dickinson, who had eloquently protested the laws passed by the British Parliament, but who had refused to sign the Declaration of Independence. We have seen from the beginning of this series how Jerusalem is a unique symbiosis of geography and theology. Joining the tribal territories of Judah and Benjamin, it is therefore a spatial recreation of Judah's penitential sacrifice for his brother Benjamin in the Joseph story, a commemoration atop a mountain for all eternity of brotherly loyalty and love. From a philosophical, moral, and spiritual perspective, the moment Menachem killed a sacred priest in Jerusalem because of political disagreements, the seeds for Jewish defeat were already sown. And, as we will see, this battle between Eliezer and Menachem marked only the first of three civil wars that will be fought within Jerusalem as the Jews of Jerusalem battle the Romans, besieging them outside the city. The phrase from the comic strip Pogo, "We have met the enemy and he is us," is so famous today that, as some note, it's easy to forget that it was itself a twist on an earlier line from Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry, who was once famous for saying, "We have met the enemy and he is ours." Traditional Jews believe that revolts against empires do sometimes succeed, and the Hasmoneans had themselves overcome an empire with the help of God in the past. But the rabbis felt that such revolutions cannot succeed. From the Jewish perspective, the enemy, if you will, cannot be ours if the enemy is also us, if the very lesson of Jerusalem is forgotten. if the ideal of Jewish brotherhood that Jerusalem embodies is desecrated and torn asunder. It's striking, therefore, that amidst the many great Zionist leaders in modernity, the one who learned the most from the ancient story of Menachem the Sakari and all that followed in his wake was a man named Menachem, who himself launched a revolt against an empire. In the 1940s, like the 60s CE, the Jews of the Holy Land were divided into many factions, and the various Zionist armies were made up of individuals that each, in their own way, desired Jewish independence. But the hatred of Haganah leader David Ben-Gurion toward the leader of another army, Menachem Begin of the Irgun, was fierce, and the Haganah did not originally back open rebellion against Britain. Then came the event known as the Saison, when the Haganah cooperated with the British in the rounding up and torture of Irgun members. At that point, a man named Menachem, meaning Begin, forbade his own soldiers from taking revenge against their fellow Jews. In his book, titled The Revolt, he explains, quote, "Strange as it may seem, for we are speaking of Irgun fighters, the decision not to retaliate, which ran counter to the very spirit of natural resistance, was honored by all of them. It was honored without a single breach to the very end." And Begin adds, "They were moved by faith, a profound faith that believed the day was not far distant when all the armed camps in Israel would stand and fight shoulder to shoulder against the oppressor. In that hope and with that faith, we said, it was worthwhile enduring grievous suffering. We dared not destroy our faith by opening a bloody abyss between those who were still brothers and might yet become comrades in arms. We saw our people in Europe in the endless procession of death. We saw the ghettos going up in flames. We saw the oppressor plotting against us all. And from down the corridors of history, we heard the echo of those other wars, the cursed internecine wars in dying Jerusalem 19 centuries before. The underground cellar is a high watchtower. Not logic, but instinct said imperatively, no, not civil war, not that at any price." And Begin concludes, "A human order would have been no avail here. The order came from somewhere, from the depths of Jewish history, and it was obeyed. We were spared the catastrophe of catastrophes, and before many months went by, the revolt embraced the whole people." End quote. We have embarked on the story of the revolt during the last days of the Second Temple, which will bring us to the story of the exile that followed. But the story of this sacred city arcs toward redemption and rebuilding, and we hope that its story will ultimately bring more profound Jewish unity. May we bear the lessons of Jerusalem's history in mind as we learn from its story and allow its tale to inspire us. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.